go ahead and call us to order and we'll get this thing started. I'm excited to be with you all today. We have a lot of good sessions coming up in this pathway on racial unity and justice. I'm going to get us started off. Let's go ahead and would you pray with me. Father, we are grateful that we come together at this moment in time, a unique set of individuals, all desiring to be like Christ. We ask that you would give us wisdom, open minds, and open hearts as we think about the hard history I'm going to tell today, and as we think hard about things we are doing well and things that we can do better in your church. We lift this day up to you. We give it over to you, and we ask that you would use our time together to form us into the likeness of Christ. We ask in Jesus' name. All right, so my session is how do we get here? So I got a couple different things I'm going to do for you. First of all, I'm going to try to tell you a story that really needs a book or a couple of books in 45 minutes. So what I've decided to do is I'm going to grab certain things anyway. I'm going to tell you the story of how did we get here. I'm especially focused on this reality: Christians who worship a Savior who broke down every potential barrier between His people. When they get together on Sunday mornings, for the most part, we segregate by this thing called race. Why? How did we get here? It's a good question for anyone who knows Jesus' prayer in John 17, 20-23. If you're not familiar, let me read it to you quickly. Jesus says in that prayer, I ask, as He prays to the Father, I ask not only on behalf of these, but also on behalf of those who will believe in Me through their word. That's us. That they may all be one, as You, Father, are in Me and I am in You, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that You have sent Me. The glory that You have given Me, I have given them, so that they may be one as We are one. I in them, You in Me, that they may become completely one, so that the world may know that You have sent Me and have loved them even as You have loved Me. So unity is essential. Unity is essential to any community that's going to call itself Christian. Therefore, the fact that Christians in the United States worship in segregated spaces should deeply trouble anyone who takes Jesus' prayer seriously. But before we can respond well to the current segregated reality, which the next four sessions of our pathway will consider, we must first answer the question, how did we get here? Why are Christians so racially divided today? So in this first session of our pathway, I'm going to provide a very brief version of a really long and a complicated story that answers our question. And so I want to look both at how we created the ideas of race and racial difference and how those ideas affected American Christians. And I'm especially, I got my eye on Churches of Christ. And so my hope for this session, this first session, is that everyone here will be able to walk away with a clear historical understanding of how race relations in American society and the church have led most Christians to segregate themselves on Sunday mornings. Now, to tell that story, what you have in front of you is a handout, and if you walked in later, I've got some extra handouts on the tables back there. You can grab those. This is me imposing four historical periods onto the past to help us make sense of the chronological development of race relations, especially if we're focusing on our question. And I have just under 10 minutes to cover each of these sections. So let's jump in. I'll have images that I won't necessarily reference, but that will be going along with my words, so feel free to take those in. Race. Race is the idea that people can be sorted into exclusive groups that are marked by physical characteristics that are perceived to be biologically inherited. Race is a construct, an idea. It is not a biological reality. And it is impossible to understand. It is impossible to understand the European classification of humanity into all these so-called races that supposedly correspond to skin color or racial features or hair type or other physical differences without first noting the historical context of colonialism and of slavery. Those are the first two items there in this first section. So let's consider first colonialism. You all know this story, but let me tell it with an eye toward our question. European nations began exploring the world in the 15th century. And they encountered people very different from themselves in the West, or on the West African coast, in the various islands, in the Pacific, in the Atlantic Oceans, and Native Americans. And here's the deal, Europeans almost immediately described and categorized the differences between their own cultures and their own people with what they perceived to be inferior cultures and people that they encountered all around the world. And they viewed the differences that they observed as signs of biological inferiority of these other groups. Now, Europeans were in a great debate about whether or not these perceived differences were unalterable or could actually be changed. Nonetheless, they were all convinced the differences suggested white or European superiority. Colonialism was key in the creation of race and in the racialization of society. I know that word will make your eyes go glassy, so let me explain what racialization of society means. I'm using it like Michael Emerson and Christian Smith use it. And here's what they say. It's basic, but they say a racialized society is a society wherein race matters profoundly for differences in life experiences, in life opportunities, and in social relationships. So a racialized society, they say, allocates different economic and political and social and even psychological rewards to groups along racial lines, lines that are socially constructed. So that's colonialism. Slavery was even more significant for Christian race relations. As European colonizers killed most Native Americans, either through conquest or disease, Europeans needed laborers to exploit the resources of their new colonies. And so for numerous reasons, they developed the brutal institution of slavery and forced over 12 million Africans into perpetual bondage against their wills. And so as European Christians with light skin, not yet really calling themselves white, as Europeans with light skin enslaved these African, what they called heathen, with dark skin, Europeans developed colonial, we'll call them triads, that link race and religion. Here are the triads they developed. They said that European began seeing themselves as white, so that's one in the triad, white, which corresponded to Christianity and freedom. You hear that triad? They said that Christianity, the light-skinned were Christian and free, whereas dark-skinned people, and for them then it was both Africans and Americans, were naturally heathen and enslaved. And so European created laws and discriminatory policies that ensured that a white supremacist racial hierarchy emerged in the European colonies. And by that, I simply mean that Europeans created colonies in which light-skinned Europeans were considered supreme or biologically superior. And by law, they had privileges that other races did not have. How did they do that? How did they do that? Well, in the 1600s, Europeans first legalized slavery, and then they passed laws that ensured that an enslaved woman's child inherited slave status. And then they passed more laws in the 1600s that prohibited race mixing. They said in these laws that, now they called them white people, were not allowed to marry African or Native American people. In the 1700s, more laws further racialized societies and solidified white supremacy by defining enslaved people as property, by limiting the protection of enslaved people against brutal masters, and limiting freedoms even within the institution of slavery. And all these discriminatory policies and laws, they had an enormous impact on the racialization of both the society and the church. So by the time the United States was founded in the 1770s, white supremacy and racial discrimination was firmly embedded in every social structure that existed. Now, next little category here that I've got in this story is Enlightenment thinkers. Enlightenment thinkers in the 17th and 18th centuries categorized people into groups according to, like you're in this group, according to their perceived behaviors and their attitudes and biological differences that they believed corresponded to physical differences such as skin color or facial shape or hair type. And Carl Linnaeus is the most famous. I've got him pictured here. He's often called the father of scientific racism. And you see his categories here in these four different races and what he believed to be biological differences and characteristics that marked those groups. And oftentimes these people think that these are unalterable traits that mark these groups. By the 10th edition of Linnaeus's Taxonomy of Human People in 1758, so this is before the founding of the United States, he had sliced humanity into four color-coded racial groups: red Americans, white Europeans, yellow Asians, and black Africans. You know the song, right? Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. The song is a lie. Yes, Jesus loves the children of the world, but children don't come in four colors. Children come in thousands of shades of beautiful colors, none of which correspond to any of the racial groups any thinkers like Linnaeus ever dreamed up. Nonetheless, American society would see endless variations of taxonomies like this one that reveal what white Americans came to believe by the 1700s. Humanity could be categorized into four or five groups that were biologically different, and every single time, white Europeans were always superior in these taxonomies. They were at the top of the hierarchy. Finally, perhaps the most important development in the colonial era, at least for our story, was Christian slavery. The most pressing issue for European Protestants in the colonial era was whether they should baptize enslaved people. You got that? Should we baptize these enslaved people? Several questions drove their debate. Did Africans or Native Americans even have the capacity to accept Christianity, they asked? Do they have souls, they asked? And if an enslaved person were baptized, would they then, the more important question, be free? Or could one be a slave and a Christian at the same time? So initially, Protestant slave owners throughout the 1600s created an exclusivist Christianity based on race. And this is a tragic. We see this in the laws. They constructed Christianity based on race, where there were two categories in their laws, Negro and Christian. They were mutually exclusive. You couldn't be Christian and Negro, and you couldn't be Negro and Christian. They were mutually exclusive. However, missionary efforts that happened in the late 1600s and in the early 1700s changed this situation. And here's how they did it. They made a persuasive case for what Catherine Gerbner, in the book that I have pictured up here, in a recent book, calls Christian slavery. And here's how they made the case to sort of overturn this exclusivist, racist view of Christianity. First, they needed laws. So colonial legislations passed laws clearly stating that baptism had nothing to do with one's physical freedom. So that made planners breathe a little easier. And then missionaries made the argument that enslaved people would be better workers and better people if they were converted. So once masters were convinced of those two things, that they could get better and more obedient workers if the enslaved people were Christianized, and religious authorities ensured the masters that slaves would not gain freedom via baptism, some of the planners started allowing enslaved people to be baptized. But slave owners launched a massive anti-conversionist resistance in the late 1600s. They feared losing their property, what they called their property, their profit, and their safety. But people like George Fox of the Quakers, Anglican and Moravian missionaries, and later evangelicals like George Whitfield, you probably heard about him, they persuaded a lot of planners by arguing that enslaved Christians were more docile and harder working than enslaved heathens. And they ensured planters that Christianity had nothing to do with an enslaved person's physical freedom. So by the era of the Great Awakening in the 1730s and 1740s, we get a trickle of enslaved people converting to Christianity, and they did so for several reasons. Missionaries taught them reading and writing, so that was appealing. Baptism could be a stepping stone to emancipation, and Christian community could be theologically and socially attractive. Not to mention some of them believed the truth of the gospel. So owners of enslaved people adapted to these conversions by creating the concept of whiteness. And they used it to protect, this concept of whiteness, to protect their social power. So by the end of the 17th century, this is just wild, and Catherine Gerbner explains this really well in her book. By the end of the 17th century, the term white started to replace Christian as the indicator of freedom and mastery. So the colonial triad of race and religion, they started passing away. No longer did white equal just Christian and free, while black or red equaled heathen and slave. Instead, any race now could become Christian. And we see a shift in the laws, in the very terminology. Now we have white and black juxtaposed, or white and red as mutually exclusive racial categories. One superior, one inferior. One free, one enslaved. In other words, missions and slave conversion were absolutely integral to the creation of new racial and religious categories. All right, so let's move on. That was my longest section. But let's move on to the segregation of the church from the founding to the Civil War. So the Atlantic Revolutions of the late 1700s and early 1800s created this unbearable cognitive dissonance for those involved in revolutions. Think about this. How do you fight and die for the idea that a creator gives all people the inalienable right of freedom, and at the very same time support an institution that systematically took away freedom from more than 12 million people? How do you do that? The idea that all men are created equal and are imbued with natural rights was really, really difficult to reconcile with lifetime involuntary slavery, unless black people could be conceived as less than human. And some did argue that, but that wasn't viable for most. So this tension between inalienable rights and taking those away is shot throughout the founding of the United States, throughout the documents. Of course, you see, right, who is at the table of power and who is not. I took out a whole section here just for time purposes, but I'd love to get into the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution with you and watch the founders squirm trying to somehow just deal with this, these two contradictory ideas. The political ideas of the 1770s, such as unalienable rights, unintentionally intensified a massive debate about slavery. So for the first time really in Western society, we get a massive abolitionist movement. And it was evangelical Christians who launched this massive abolitionist movement that powerfully shaped the story I'm telling you today. Leaders among the Methodists, right, the Baptists, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, and even Barton Stone's Christians related to the Stone Campbell movement all joined in the fight against slavery for a minute in the late 1700s. Let me give you a few examples, just so you're aware of the sharp contrast, and nobody gets to say that they were just products of their time. In 1774, John Wesley said slavery, the leader of the Methodists, he said slavery could not be reconciled with justice, mercy, or Christianity, and he said God would atone for the blood of the slaves with the blood of the traitors and the owners. In 1780, the Baltimore Methodist Conference declared slavery, and I'm quoting here, contrary to the laws of God, man, and nature, and hurtful to society. And they encouraged all Methodists to free their slaves. In 1784, a Methodist conference voted to expel all those who bought or held slaves. I mean, they're kicking people out of the church. In 1789, Virginia Methodist, as you see pictured here, James O'Kelly, he was later a leader of the Christian movement, related to the Stone Campbell movement, he wrote an anti-slavery pamphlet in which he said Satan had created the institution of slavery. And in 1800, Barton Stone presented a resolution to the West Lexington Presbytery stating slavery was a moral evil and those who continued the practice should be removed from the Presbyterian church. And so you will not be surprised when I tell you African Americans began converting to evangelical Christianity in large numbers for the first time during the early 1800s. Historians point to numerous explanations for this phenomenon, but let me say that I think evangelical anti-slavery must be considered one of the main reasons. This religious group seemed to care about the well-being of the enslaved people. But there were other things that enticed folks as well. Evangelicalism preached an egalitarian message, at least at its best. All people who experienced a new birth conversion were spiritual equals. So that's an egalitarian message. And evangelical revivalism, historians point out, also offered some ideas and practices that had some continuity with the African religious past. And so for these and for some other reasons, many free and enslaved black people converted to Christianity in the early 19th century. Tragically, white evangelicals largely abandoned abolitionism by the 1810s. As these new denominations grew, they lost their prophetic edge. The same people who had called slavery satanic 20 years before, now in 1810, were saying that they would focus only on converting the enslaved people rather than emancipating them. Why? Why do we get white evangelicals accommodating what they see as a satanic system? Why? Well, first, even emancipationist white Christians had thoroughly imbibed the racist messages of their culture. Almost all still believed in black inferiority. Second, evangelical denominations quickly grew into influential institutions. And that growth led to compromise with the slaveholding converts in the South. With their newfound cultural respectability, white evangelicals often moved away from countercultural critique of American institutions like slavery. And third, colonization swooped in the 1810s. And it became a favorite option for white anti-slavery evangelicals in the 1820s, including Barton Stone. That is, the American Colonization Society promoted the idea of colonizing freed black people in Africa. And you need to know that this idea was rooted in white people's beliefs that white and black people could not live together in an integrated society. This tragic failure of evangelical culture and evangelical churches must have been absolutely devastating to black converts who had come into evangelical fold under emancipationist preaching. But abolitionism did continue, and it merged largely in the 1830s, and some evangelicals did lead or at least join the movement. The most influential anti-slavery advocates of this era were formerly enslaved people. No doubt you know this is the image of Frederick Douglass. He was probably the most famous among the early abolitionists who were formerly enslaved people. And he has this much-quoted passage from his autobiography where he offers a prophetic critique of slave Christianity, where again, he forces all white people to reckon with, for our time today, he continues to make it hard to say they were just people of their time. They didn't hear a clear argument. Here's what Douglass says. This is a quote from his biography. He says, "What I have said respecting and against religion, I mean strictly to apply to the slaveholding religion of this land and with no possible reference to Christianity proper. For between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference. So wide that to perceive the one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to reject the other as bad, corrupt, and wicked." Sounds like an evangelical in the 1780s and 1790s. "To be the friend of the one is of necessity to be the enemy of the other. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slave-holding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land." Douglass and those like him critiqued the racist system and racist ideas that the system had produced. So-called Christians in the South had been so morally corrupted by the institution that they no longer deserved the name Christian. That's a hard teaching. Free black Christians in the North not only advocated for abolition, they also left white churches throughout the 1800s, usually because of the racism that they experienced in white churches. This was the case with Richard Allen and the African Methodist Episcopal Church, but there were others as well. And this really is, if you want the race relations story of the 19th century church in America, Christians of color left white churches as soon as they could because of the suffocating racism they experienced in those white churches. Black Christians created independent black congregations and independent denominations throughout the 19th century. But enslaved Christians in the South did not have this freedom. Many went to white churches where they heard the gospel of slavery, obey your masters, don't steal, don't lie. Some went to black churches with white supervision, like the one you see here. And many went to the secret black prayer meetings out of the view of whites. And based on the many autobiographies we have and the interviews of formerly enslaved people, we know that these secret meetings were common. And this is where black Christianity flourished, in areas where slavery dominated. In response to the emancipation movement in the 1700s, and the abolition movement in the 1830s, every time you get a move forward in civil rights or justice, you always have a racist resistance and racist backlash. And in the 1800s, it came in the form of a formidable synthesis from pro-slavery folks of the Bible, economics, and politics to state their white supremacist case and their case for slavery. So the most important passage in their arsenal was Genesis 9. The curse of Ham, you're welcome. This actually image comes from a Bible, and it is graphic, so I censored it for you. But this is the story. This is why you don't get graphic novels in the Bible. Kids could not read them. The most important Bible passage in their arsenal was Genesis 9. You know that passage, right? The curse of Ham. In the passage, Noah's son Ham looked on his naked and drunk father inappropriately, and therefore Noah cursed Ham's son Canaan to be a servant of his brothers. That's the story. Pro-slavery Christians said that the mark of the curse was black skin. Canaan's descendants were obviously Africans, whom God had ordained to be slaves for all time. Now, of course, this Rachel gloss is just that, something they added to the biblical text to create a justification for the institution of slavery, from which they benefited enormously. We don't have the time to go into their use of the Bible to support, that's one of the passages they used to support white supremacy, but I'd also be interested in exploring at length with you the passages they used to support the institution of slavery, but let me just sum it up for you. In short, they argued that God set up slavery in the Old Testament, that God defined how the institution should operate in the Old Testament, and neither Jesus nor the apostles condemned slavery. In fact, they pointed you to several of the household codes written by the apostles that told slaves to be good slaves and masters to be good masters. So, whether in the North or in the South, Christians of color experienced, just summing up this era, Christians of color experienced racism in white churches, and therefore the segregation of the church was spiritually complete, at least, by the time of the Civil War, even though it took new freedoms to make that spiritual segregation fully manifest in physically segregated congregations following the Civil War. So now let's look at racial estrangement in the United States following the Civil War up to the Civil Rights Movement of the 50s. So the fight over slavery led the U.S. into a massive civil war that finally abolished slavery and created the first wave of civil rights for people of color. I'm calling this Civil Rights One. All right, you could maybe call civil rights earlier, but there was nothing that actually touched civil rights. So we're calling this Civil Rights One. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution in the 1860s made slavery illegal and ensured that all people born or naturalized in the U.S. were citizens and had the right to vote. Now, immediately, as the image you see here in the South, massive racist resistance to black civil rights emerged. And it emerged in several forms, especially the form of white supremacist organizations like the Ku Klux Klan and a political movement of what we call redeemers, or they call themselves redeemers, who sought to take back control from what they viewed as northern aggressors. As Michael Emerson and Christian Smith put it, the 4 million former slaves were now 4 million people without land, with few economic resources, without much formal education, without even cooking utensils, and surrounded by hostile people who wanted to prove that the new era was a mistake. What the United States needed was repair, was reparations, and they tried. The U.S. government passed laws that attempted to force the South to live by the new rules. The government tried to help formerly enslaved people learn how to read and write and to learn new trades. Some Christians joined the cause, but discrimination won out as redeemer governments took over the South, took over the Southern states, one by one in the 1870s. New white elites passed laws and codes calculated to keep free black people in as close to a state as bondage as possible. This is an image of the five military breakdown of the Southern states by the U.S. government that just eventually didn't work. So a really important development for Christian relations in this whole era, especially in the South, is something called lost cause religion. Historian Charles Regan Wilson argues that Southern civil religion or lost cause religion was a product of the confluence of Christian churches and Southern cultures. So what you get here and what you're seeing a little bit in this image is that the South identified, you know this, right, that the South had identified that God's cause with the Confederate cause. They were inextricably linked. Therefore, when the Confederates lost the war, it created a serious spiritual and psychological crisis and a need among Southerners to explore their own identity. Their hopes of autonomous political identity were lost. No more Confederacy, but Southerners now could fight for their cultural and religious identity. The reaffirmation of their identity came in this lost cause religion as Southerners linked their religious and their cultural values together. So in sum, this is what lost cause religion is. The South was not wrong about the racial hierarchy or about slavery. That's not why God punished them with a loss in the war. Instead, they said they had been sinful and God had hoped to refine them in this difficult time. And if they remained pure, perhaps the South would rise again. And the primary, you should know, constructors and disseminators of lost cause religion were the evangelical preachers, especially Baptists. The churches of Christ are not off the hook. In the political arena, Jim Crow laws segregated every aspect of public life in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and the churches followed suit. And here's the deal. I need to point this out because this continues to be a real hard problem for white Christians. As inequalities compounded in communities of color due to discriminatory, separate but equal policies and laws, most white Christians continued to think that equality had been achieved. There's no more slavery. And so when people highlighted problems like this cartoon faced by communities of color, you know what white Christians believed? It was the fault of communities of color. They needed moral upbringing, a better work ethic. And here's the deal, and Ibram Kendi makes this point over and over in his recent book, Stamped from the Beginning. Rather than seeing racial disparities as the result of racist policies, white people often believed the disparities reflected a problem with the racial group, a racist explanation rather than the obvious explanation. Lynching became common during this time. White people lynched over 4,000 individuals, mostly black men. Although some white Christians opposed lynchings, many participated in and condoned lynching as a means of social control. Believing their own racist propaganda, white people were terrified that black men wanted to rape white women. In some instances, lynching became even a ritual of white purification, which is one reason burning lynch victims often took place. People like Ida B. Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois brought the lynching to light and forced the American public again to reflect on its racism and its discrimination. No one was simply a person of their time. After a 1906 race riot, Du Bois published a powerful prayer. If I had time, I'd love to read it. To a God who seemed silent. Oh, silent God, it starts and it ends. While black bodies were destroyed without legal ramifications. The year after Du Bois published his prayer, racism among churches of Christ was on full display in the pages of the Gospel Advocate, as members of a white congregation publicly debated whether or not a black girl should be allowed to attend a church, a white church with a white family, because there was a perfectly good black church down the road, and we don't want her here with us. The writings of Samuel Robert Cassius are glorious. They provide a breath of fresh air in the midst of a horrible era. They provide a black man's perspective on race relations in churches of Christ at the time. Cassius provided the traditional biblical citation to argue for the equality of black people because he still had to make this argument. Acts 17:26, you know the passage, God made of one blood all nations of people. Cassius believed that all black people needed to all they needed to succeed was education. And he tried to create institutions for black people to learn trades and evangelization. But he had a lot of trouble getting money from white people to support his endeavors because he blatantly called out racism. He identified two causes of racism. Here are the causes of racism in American society: Southern culture and the church. Southern culture's racism, he said, was present in its taking away the black vote by using terror, unfair examinations, and poll taxes, and in the white people's perpetuation of the lie that black men constantly raped white women. Cassius accurately noted that it was, in fact, Southern white men who victimized black women. And in terms of the church's role in constructing a racist society, Cassius found that even Christians in the North believed that black people were inferior to white people. Some churches wouldn't even let Cassius speak in the pulpit because he was a, quote-unquote, Negro. He called white racism unbiblical. He said it was a lie from hell created by the devil, and that it destroyed the church. And he was about as prophetic and acerbic as Frederick Douglass was. Because of the racism he experienced, Cassius, interestingly, was a racial separatist. He did not want to integrate white and black society because he was convinced that white people's racism would always destroy black people's social peace and happiness. In the South, then, racism in society, summing up this era, and the church, led to the final segregation of the Christian churches. Almost all black Christians left white churches as soon as they were legally or financially able. White Christians sometimes did cooperate with black Christians, offering paternalistic oversight of missionary ventures or educational societies. And although some black individuals despised or even rejected funds from paternalistic whites, others worked the system pretty well. Marshall Keble is a great example of this. He used white money, often offered in paternalistic ways, to educate the civil rights leaders who tore down the segregated walls of society. It's a great twist of justice in history. However, even in these cases of cooperation, black and white Christians remain thoroughly segregated in the South and in the North. Before I move on to the last section, I should note that the Great Migration, which is absolutely fundamental in shaping American race relations in the North changed dramatically from 1910 to 1930, as more than 1 million black people migrated from below the Mason-Dixon line to these northern cities you see pictured here. And up to that point, about 90% of black people still lived in the South. So white northerners did not have much interaction with black individuals. The Great Migration changed all that. Almost immediate racist backlash occurred in the 1910s and 20s. Northern neighborhoods, schools, churches, and every other social public institution segregated, sometimes by law, sometimes by informal racist policies and racist agreements. Some interracial movements did emerge in the 1920s and 1930s, especially with the ecumenical movement. Regardless, these were decades of racial estrangement in society and church. But a new day was dawning. The civil rights movement began before the 1950s, surely, but several events in the 1950s signaled that a new era had arrived in American race relations. Black Christian leaders led the fight for civil rights in American society. People like Martin Luther King Jr. and our own Churches of Christ, Fred Gray, opposed segregation and fought for equality in jobs, education, and voting. Christians of color made the case that the Christian gospel was inextricably related to the civil rights of people in society. The gospel, they argue, was about the liberating God seen in the story of the Exodus, and about God's concern for social justice as found in the Old Testament prophets. Unfortunately, at the same time, white conservative Christians typically argued that civil rights were not part of the Christian gospel. And throughout the 20th century, white evangelical Christians had developed a Christian tradition that really placed conversion of souls and individual discipleship at the center of Christianity's concern. And therefore, white Christians missed a whole lot of opportunities to join black sisters and brothers in the fight for rights and against injustice. There were some important exceptions, such as the Churches of Christ leaders writing in the journal Mission. But most often, white Christians were silent or antagonistic. In fact, King argued in his famous letter from Birmingham Jail that the white moderate is the white person who says and does nothing as injustice happens against people of color. The white person is the black person's greatest stumbling block. King said that the white moderate, I'm quoting from him here, prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. And he continued with what I think is the most prophetic statement in the letter for today. He said, quote, "We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of bad people, but for the appalling silence of good people." As has been the case throughout American history, every burst of civil rights activity has been met with racist resistance. And white evangelicals who did not want their white children going to school with children of color reiterated their traditional arguments for the segregation of society and the church in the 1960s. In 1960, leading evangelical, this is a little pamphlet by Bob Jones, argued that segregation was, in fact, scriptural. You know which text he used. It was the traditional text, Acts 17, 26 to 27. Now, you remember, Cassius used that, whereas egalitarians such as Cassius used the first part of the verse to argue that all people were equal. Christian segregationists used the last part of the verse to argue that God had ordained separation of the world's racial groups. Listen to the passage. "God hath made of one blood all nations of men," egalitarian, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, this is KJV, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord in those bounds, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. Jones subtly equated nations and races to make this passage work for his racist purposes. Since God established places for races to dwell, and therefore did not want the races dwelling together, I just would like to read you sections from this because you draw the drop. Those who tried to wipe away the color line, whether through integration or through interracial marriage in America, were part of a satanic and communist attempt to overthrow God's established order. And many white evangelicals agreed with Jones. That's why all the white institutions were segregated. But as it became clear, in fact, you all may be aware of this, the religious right began with this anti-integration platform of Jones. But as it became clear that they would not get their segregated way in America, or if they did, they would lose their tax money or their government money, and as abortion became a key cultural battleground, the religious right rallied around abortion instead of segregation. And white Christian schools who had for so long refused to allow people of color into their halls were now forced by the government to change their racist policies. Amid these struggles, some in Churches of Christ tried to improve race relations. The Nashville, Tennessee, Schrader Lane Church of Christ proposed and hosted a race relations workshop in 1968 to bring together lots of different races together for mutual understanding and consideration. I'm going to skip through a little bit of this that talks about this, but later that same year, 1968, and the Black Churches of Christ led it, and David Jones Jr., the Schrader Lane minister, did not candy coat it. He said, our church is racist, and we're sick of paternalism, and it's time for black people to be honest about this, and if we're going to be at the table, we're all going to be honest, and no more paternalism, no more racism. 1968, later on, a number of folks came together and put an acknowledgement of racism out in Atlanta, and they signed it, and they listed 28 things that mostly still you and I could do as institutions, as individuals, as churches, to better race relations and work for social justice. But let me move on to the last bit of my talk here as time's running out. In the last several decades of the 1900s, black evangelicals, including John Perkins, Tom Skinner, Samuel Hines, and as I just noted, a number in Churches of Christ, started the racial reconciliation movement. As Hines put it, reconciliation was God's one-item agenda, and the leaders, they proposed four major steps to achieve reconciliation. You should know, one of the steps is to recognize, everyone has to recognize social structures of inequality, and everyone has to oppose them together. Without that, we cannot have racial reconciliation. They said, black evangelicals said, in the late 1970s, 1980s, okay? I would tell you the four planks, but again, for the interest of time, I just want you to be aware that that's the key theme I want to end on. So white evangelicals joined this racial reconciliation movement in droves. They published all kinds of stuff. It was so significant that in 1997, the Wall Street Journal said that the evangelicals were the most energetic element of society addressing racial relations. But white evangelicals lost something in the translation from the black start to the white joining. They lost the focus on systems and social justice, and in translation, just focused on individual reconciliation. People should be kind to one another, for white evangelicals, it's been very, very difficult to recognize how significant the systemic issues are and how people of color are affected by those because they are not affected by them. So we continue to see this issue in the most recent events. This issue of white people missing in translation, in white evangelical responses to the Black Lives Matter movement. In the wake of the killing of Trayvon Martin, whose crime was having Skittles and tea, you see the Black Lives Matter hashtag emerge, right? And as I'm out of time, I'm just going to step away and just explain to you what you're seeing here. Studies are showing that basically perceptions of reality between white people and people of color are enormous. As you see here, when asked, hey, Are these killings of black men by police, are these broader pattern, are these systemic? Are these shaped by 400 years of white supremacy and racist institutions? Or are these just individual isolated events? Well, if you're black, 75% of you would say, yeah, this is a systemic problem. I'm a good person, but I get, you know, followed around to school. But if you're white, you're only 43% there. But note, the more conservative Christian you get, the more white you see reality. That's called the racial perception gap. And it grows. The perception of reality grows. I've got another one here, but I won't mention that. Let me just give you a quick conclusion. I've skipped a lot of history and important points, but I hope I covered enough to show how we got here. In summary, Christian churches segregate on Sunday mornings because of the sin of racism throughout our history. Individual and systemic racism. White people build a society with white people at the top of a racial hierarchy, and every time civil rights for other groups of people have won, some white people have always resisted. From resisting Reconstruction to resisting 1960s civil rights to resisting Black Lives Matter. The historical and current sins of racism, along with the difficulty of white people to recognize systemic racism, will continue to hinder racial justice and unity. But the racial reconciliation movement has increased the number of multi-ethnic churches, and maybe we're in an upswing. We have several people in the other pathways who are going to bring wisdom to continuing struggle for racial justice and unity. But for now, let's take a break.